would not travel with him.
Oh, well, I've got 9 o'clock, so I'm going to start even if the bell hasn't rung. Okay, so we are in lesson 3, lesson 4, chapter 3, talking about Haman today, and we'll look at a few verses in chapter 5 because they are revealing as far as Haman's character is concerned. I wanted to just say one more thing about assimilation, which we talked about last time. So Esther is about God's people trying to live in a pagan world, which is a really good is a really good example for us as God's people trying to live in a pagan world. And I think there are some good lessons to learn. And I kind of zoomed through these at the end. I'm not going to spend a whole lot more time on them today. But I would just say that there are examples in Esther and principles in the New Testament that would tell us that we do have some responsibility to assimilate, but always for the purpose of doing God's work more effectively. And the assimilation that we are commanded to do is not an excuse and should not be to the point of presenting additional temptations to compromise on morals and truth. But we do have some of these responsibilities. Last week I argued that Esther was very passive in chapter 2 and even morally compromised. Today I'm going to argue that Mordecai is not much better. You're welcome to disagree with me on those things, but I want to point this out. Maybe we're intended to see Esther and Mordecai as morally weak, in contrast, say, with Daniel and his friends who were in a similar situation. And we're intended to see them that way so that the story of Esther can show us how God can transform people who are willing to whatever extent they know how to do, who are willing to stand up for him even after they've compromised themselves. Because let's be honest, that's where all of us are, probably all the time, but certainly when we first come to obey the gospel, right? We've already compromised ourselves. We have assimilated more than we ought to have with the world by virtue of our sin. And now we are trying to take a stand to the best of our ability, to the best of our knowledge. And I think it's useful for us to see in the examples of Esther and Mordecai that God can and does use people who find themselves in that kind of compromised position but are willing to take the action that they know to take. So in the coming chapters, we're going to see Esther and Mordecai come to rely more on God and more fully entrust themselves to his providence. And I think maybe that's the context for Mordecai's statement later. Who knows whether you come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Part of it is rooted in this decision that he and Esther have both made individually, but they've both made it to take a stand now instead of just trying to blend in. So I would encourage you, as you're reading back through Esther later, to look for these lessons about assimilation, to see how they match up with New Testament principles, see where the characters may be assimilated too much, and where they provide good examples to kind of guide our functioning in the world without being of the world, as Paul said. Well, he didn't actually say in the world, but not of the world. That's our summary, so you know what I'm talking about. So that's just one other thing I wanted to say about that. Our objectives for today, fairly simple, to name the Old Testament character and nation with whom the text intends us to associate Haman, and to list at least 3 parallels between Mordecai and Joseph. So here's our outline of Esther. We've been looking at this every time. This section, Haman's plot, is parallel with his plot unraveling in chapter 8. But there are actually further parallels contained within these 2 sections. So in chapter 3, verses 1 and 2, Haman is made the grand vizier and everyone is forced to honor him. In 8:15, which we'll look at in a few lessons, Mordecai is made the grand vizier. It's not quite stated explicitly in that verse. It actually is stated explicitly in chapter 10. But in 8, the context is clear that Haman Mordecai is replacing Haman. But in 8:15, when Mordecai is made grand vizier, everyone rejoices. Everyone is happy. There's a contrast there between the king having to make a law that you have to bow down to Haman and everyone willingly, rejoicingly submitting to Mordecai's authority. And so those, I think, were intended to see those contrasts. Let's start by reading. This up. If I could get someone to read chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, and then someone else can turn ahead to chapter 5 and read verses 9 through 14 when the first person finishes.
Okay. Scott. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman. For so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. And the king's servants who were with the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman, to see whether Mordecai's words would stand. For Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. For they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai.
Good. And then 5, 9 through 14. Chapter 5 is after chapter 4. It doesn't matter. You can't go with it.
All right. So Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife Zeresh. Then Haman told them of his great riches, the multitude of his children, everything in which the king had promoted him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and servants of the king. Moreover, Haman said, "Besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come in with the king to the banquet that she prepared, and tomorrow I am again invited by her, along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Then the wife of Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high, and in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And if things please Haman, so you have a gallows made."
Okay. Like all the other characters in the story, Haman is presented in an absurd way. It's exaggeration, hyperbole, all those things are going on. But what do you find interesting or significant about Haman? Or funny, I guess. Yes.
He's got all these things and he's great honor, but he's like super duper concerned with like the one guy who's not
attention
to him. Right. Who's on like a woodwork class strata. So
yes.
Like, dude, you got all this,
right?
Focusing on
us. Yeah. Do you know anybody like that who's got every measure of success that the world can assign and yet is insecure about everything? That's him. One guy can ruin his entire life. Yes.
Also, he seems much more concerned about the benefits of his position than actually doing the work that he's supposed to be doing. There's no discussion about him being a good official.
Right. In fact, there's even some hints that he's not a good official, which we'll look at. But that's a good observation.
I remember from the first and second Samuel study I did that noticing chapter 3, verse 1 says Haman was a son of an Agagite.
Yeah.
Which would reach back to the Amalekites, it would seem, that should have been destroyed long ago.
Exactly. So he's listed here as an Agagite. Now, Agag is the title for the king of Amalek. It's not his name. It's kind of like Abimelech. You know, it's a title, probably, and not the guy's actual name. And you can look at Numbers 24. Balaam's prophecy, and he kind of says that that Israel will have superiority over the Agag. So what's the Agag? Well, it would be the king of the Amalekites. There's some argument that because he has a Persian, his dad has a Persian name, that he's therefore not a descendant of the Amalekites. To which I would respond, well, Daniel and his friends and Mordecai and Esther all had Persian names. It didn't make them not Jewish. But anyway, I think the point in the text, whether it's literally true that he's a descendant of that particular Agag or of another king of the Amalekites or just an Amalekite in general, he's a son of Agag. And remember what we talked about family identity, that he's identified as a son of Agag, and whether it's literally true or just figuratively true in the same way that Jesus would say, you're of your father, the devil, we are intended to see this person, as David pointed out, as a part of this nation that God had commanded the Israelites to destroy. Yes?
And also, if you look at the original story, the Amalekites were supposed to be wiped out, and this is Saul's failure that they survived.
That's right.
So then you have a survivor of Saul's failure that is now threatening to wipe out the Jews, like the Amalekites should.
That's right. And so this, I think that suggests to us that this conflict between Mordecai and Haman in the book of Esther is more than just a personal disagreement or a personal conflict. Haman is promoted. We'll talk a little bit more about what that means in a second. But I wonder if Mordecai thinks that that's the place he should have been given as a reward for his service to the king, saving the king's life. I'll present some more evidence for that in just a second, but there is a personal side to it. I want to emphasize that. But also, there is this commandment in Exodus. This is the battle where Moses holds his hands up and he gets tired, and Aaron and Hur hold up his hands, and Joshua defeats the Amalekites. And after that battle, God says, this is a perpetual law. You must wipe out the Amalekites because they fought against my people. In some traditions for celebrating Purim, apparently you read these verses before you start reading the Book of Esther as part of the celebration. That's the historical background. That's the precursor to the events. It's the prequel to the story, so that you have some context going into this. So Saul's battle in 1 Samuel 15, where Samuel says you need to go do this, is supposed to be part of this holy war. And I'm calling it holy war because one of the characteristics of holy war in the Bible is that you don't take spoil. Like, think of Jericho, right? Don't take any spoil, destroy everything that's devoted to God. That's what Saul doesn't do. He disobeys that law, which is not just he didn't do what Samuel told him to do. He's actually violating the principle that God had laid out for how Amalek was to be destroyed, which is utterly, everything is to be destroyed, no spoil taken.
Hey Mason, so I'm clear, so you're saying that it is the standard Jewish interpretation today that this is Amalekite versus Israelite. Like, that's how this is understood.
That is how the text is presented to us. There's a different question, which would be, did Mordecai see it this way? And that is an intriguing question, and I'll talk more about that in a second. But yes, certainly the Israelites, both who were reading this, or the Jews who were reading this book for the first time and who are still reading it today, would view it that way. Mm-hmm. And I think because the text specifically points out that Mordecai is a descendant of Kish and the Benjamite, and that Haman is an Agagite, not a Amalekite, an Agagite, I think is an intentional callback to this historic conflict. But Haman restarts the war trying to reverse the decree. He's going to take out the Israelites instead of the Israelites taking out the Amalekites. And so they're replaying this conflict between Saul and Agag and between Israel and Amalek. So Haman, we didn't read these verses, we'll read them in just a second, but Haman gets the king to make this law that, oh, sorry, this is before that. Notice that the king has to make a law that people have to bow down to Haman, right? Again, this is this typical micromanaging of Ahasuerus. You can drink whatever you want to, or not at all, or as much as you want. The rule is there is no rule. And now he's making a rule that you have to bow down to the Grand Vizier. But I wonder if the fact that he has to make this rule is a kind of a statement implicitly about how people feel about him, right? That they dislike him so much that they won't even obey the custom of bowing down to the person who's superior to them, so the king has to step in and make a rule so that people will actually do what they're supposed to do. Yes?
And also, again, it's just like, Haman is the worst. You know, right. His position is to help the king. And throughout the entire story, what you see is a grand vizier that is more of an inconvenience to his king than a help.
Works against him, really. And we'll see that in this chapter. But again, so in 8:15, I cited this verse earlier, but it's that when Mordecai is made the grand vizier, everyone rejoices, in contrast with Haman, where everyone has to be, you know, told explicitly to bow down to him. So just if you're interested, this is the king's gate at Susa. This is the entrance from the outside in the palace courtyard, is kind of where we are. But this is the gateway. You can see how big it is. And so all the people who were sitting in the gate would have been sitting in this kind of area. This also is kind of roughly what would have been going on in Ruth, where the men are sitting in the gate, much smaller, of course, but similar kind of idea. That the gate is, there's two entryways, and between those two gates is where everybody sits. The other thing that's interesting about this picture, just maybe a little bit of speculation, but you can see these kind of chambers back here, and there's one on the other side with little entryways. It's not real clear what those would have been used for. It could have been guard houses. It could have been storage. But I kind of imagine that in chapter 3 here, where Haman refuses to bow down, and the king's servants said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command? They had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen." I kind of imagine that, you know, Haman parades through and everybody bows down. Which, by the way, is not necessarily like falling down on the ground and rubbing your face in the dirt. It's probably just a kind of, we would think of it as like a formal, you know, English bow or something. In other words, it wouldn't be that hard for Mordecai to not get away with it, because it's not like everybody's laying down flat and he's just standing there. But the people around him would notice, and they would see what he was doing, and they'd ask him, and he'd explain, and it would become more obvious as the days went on to those around him. But Haman doesn't notice it at first. But I just kind of imagine that Haman kind of parades through it, and like, "Mordecai, come here," and they kind of like duck around the corner. What are you doing? Why are you acting in this way? I just point that out to say that, you know, when you look at the sort of the physical place where these things happen, it kind of makes the story a little more human. You can kind of see them calling Mordecai and ducking around the corner saying, "Are you sure this is the best idea? You know, maybe you should consider bowing to him." But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting... But this would be the literal gate where this story takes place. This is the place. So somewhere in that courtyard is where all this happened. So, I've already kind of described it a little bit, but Mordecai refuses to bow down, but let's read, we already read those verses, so I don't need to. What do you think about this? Why does he refuse to bow down? I'm willing to take what you've heard or just your own wild speculations about what's going on here. Yes?
Well, how because he thinks Haman's kind of an idiot, and then B, maybe it's meant to be like another comparison back to, you know, where Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego used to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol.
Right. So that gets at a couple of potential solutions. The problem is Haman's not a god, right? But there is something worth investigating there. Specifically, there's a tradition that kind of plays to that idea. But what else have you heard or thought?
Verses 3 to 7 seem to connect it to his Jewish identity.
Yeah, and so what does that mean? I can't do it because I'm Jewish.
Well, if you go back to what you said, you could relate to one God, I'm not going to bow down. If there has to be some connection to that idea of worship, or certainly Ahasuerus would have been seen as a god.
Yeah.
And is now the position that Haman has somehow being connected to it. And even if it wasn't real, if Mordecai saw that as somewhat of a connection.
Yeah.
But he's explaining something more that we don't know. And it is
potentially
to his Jewishness.
Yeah. At least
well,
in his mind.
He's explaining to the people why he's not bowed down. We don't get the whole explanation of it. So.
Maybe.
You think we get the whole
thing? Have you ever refused to do something that's wrong just by saying, I'm a Christian, and not actually giving the principles that would guide that decision?
He just said,
I'm Jewish.
Right.
I don't know. I'm reading as much into the text as you are, but I think it's possible. So there is some, I mean, obviously, I'll talk about some of these in a second, but there is the possibility from some other sources that that the king's order about Haman conferred some sort of associative divinity from the king, and maybe that was part of what Mordecai was taking a stand against. Anything else? Yes.
I mean, I think that is the best possible explanation.
Best in what sense?
It gives Mordecai the benefit of the doubt.
Oh, right.
But also, again, if you see this tension between him and Haman as personal, this is extremely convenient. You know, I can't do that for religion.
Right.
Actually, like, I hate this guy.
Right.
You know, and I don't, you don't really want to assume the worst, but there's definitely different options.
Yep. So this is a little bit problematic, and it's precisely because of what Russ pointed out, that the text doesn't explain clearly what's going on here. What is clear is that he refuses to bow down to him. And I also think it's noteworthy as far as kind of establishing character that the other people in the gate give Mordecai many, many chances to both bow down and to explain himself before they finally go to Haman with it. And again, that may show a preference for Mordecai over Haman, at least in terms of character. Like Mordecai, we like you. We don't want you to get in trouble. You know, we're going to give you as many chances as we can to fix this. But his explanation is that he's a Jew. But the basic responses or the explanations fall into a couple of categories. One has to do with idolatry, and the choices there are one rabbinic explanation was that Haman had a tattoo of a god on his chest, and so Mordecai thought, if I bow down to him, I'm bowing down to the god that's tattooed on his chest, and that's idolatry. That's pure speculation. But I guess it's a possibility. The other one is that sort of associative divinity from the king that I mentioned. But some are just, it's just kind of black and white, that Jews only bow down to God. All of these, though, have problems. First of all, Jews are not forbidden to bow down to those in authority. And in fact, in 2 Samuel 19, Shimei, who's a descendant of Saul, bows down to David, who's the king. Now you might say, well, David's Jewish, so that's okay. In Genesis 59, that's where Joseph's brothers bow down to him, as his dream had foretold that they would. And you think, oh, well, he's Jewish too, so that's okay. But they didn't know that at the time. They didn't know who he was. As far as they were concerned, they were bowing down to an Egyptian. And that seemed to be okay with them. At least in the sense of not being killed. Okay. There's no law against bowing down to those in authority. You're not worshiping them, you're bowing down to them as a sign of respect. And there are examples, even from within Mordecai's own family, of people doing exactly that to someone not a king and in a position of authority. So that's a little bit problematic. Now, one possibility is that Mordecai could be recalling God's orders about destroying the Amalekites. In other words, God didn't tell us to honor these people. He told us to destroy them, so I'm not going to, you know, I can't kill him, but I'm at least not going to honor him or something. Again, we don't know that. All Mordecai says is, I'm a Jew. But bound up in that could be this law that God gave the Jews about the Amalekites. But I want to point out another thing, which is that it could just be personal. It could be that Mordecai is resentful of Haman's promotions. And the reason that that's a possibility is that Persian kings were prided themselves on rewarding their benefactors very richly. It was kind of one of the things they were known for, is their generousness to people who had served them well. And Mordecai was not rewarded. That becomes a plot point later in the story. But some of the ways that Persian kings would reward their benefactors are exempting them from taxes. But the king's already done that as part of Esther's promotion, right? He has said no more taxes for a while. We'll see in chapter 10 that he reinstitutes them. So at this point, Mordecai's already not paying taxes, so that's not available as a reward. They would sometimes promote them to a place of honor, to sit in the gate. Well, Mordecai had that before he even saved the king's life, so he can't give him that as a reward for his service. But another very common reward was an exemption from the obeisance that was due to other and superior nobles in the kingdom. In other words, you didn't have to bow down to people, even if they were your superiors, because of what you had done for the king. And so I wonder, again, just speculation, but I wonder if Mordecai is kind of saying, well, I'm just going to take my own reward then. I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to not bow down to Haman because this is what I deserve. So maybe that's what's going on. I would just say, in summary, this is speculative. In fact, all of these interpretations are a little bit speculative. But it is clear that he has no scriptural reason for refusing to bow down. And the other thing that I think is clearly true is, if he was in the habit of not bowing down to the king, he'd be dead. So the idea that he just didn't bow down to anybody except God doesn't really hold water in the context. So the fact that no substantial explanation is given, either by Mordecai or the author, may indicate that his refusal to bow is simply pettiness or pride. But what I want us to see is that, in any case, whether it's a matter of principle, a matter of just dislike, or a matter of dislike disguised by principle, which, let's be honest, we do that kind of thing too sometimes. I can't help you with this thing. I've got to go, you know, do my Bible lesson or something like that. But whatever is going on, whether his reason is good or bad, Mordecai jeopardizes his entire race by refusing to bow down. It's a matter of custom, really, not of idolatry. And the other thing is, he keeps refusing to bow down to him even after the decree has been passed that all the Jews should be killed. It's like he's so stubborn that even when he clearly sees the consequences of his action, he still refuses to comply. And even when it's abundantly clear that because of his action, his people are targeted for destruction. And so I have a hard time seeing what Mordecai is doing. Right or wrong, I guess we can't really make that. I have a hard time seeing it as the best course of action. Yes.
Just wanted to ask you, is there a difference between bowing and paying homage?
The word is used, it's the same word, and it's used for both. So it's really, I think, the difference would be a matter of attitude, right? More than the word is used to describe it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just said bow and pay homage. So,
to
somebody, but not be paying homage to.
I thought you were comparing to other texts. No, right. In this context, it's all the kind of the same thing, but it would, you could think of it as, you know, like bowing down, and also, I think actually in chapter 5, we read, it says, that he did not stand up or tremble or move for him, right? And I think that could be standing up as a sign of respect, and trembling or moving as kind of like backing out of the way. You know what I mean? Kind of clearing a path for him. So it's maybe a two-step process of showing deference, It's not really clear. We don't know a whole lot about those specific customs. But does that help a little bit? You're trying to rescue Mordecai by...
No, I'm just wondering if it had more to do with worship. When it says pay homage.
I see.
And therefore, it wouldn't be a matter of showing respect, which
right.
a bow could be. It would be a matter of showing respect and worship.
Yeah. That's a possibility. I would just say, on the other hand, that you'd have the same conflict bowing down to the king who viewed himself as a god, which Mordecai kind of has to have done to still be alive, right? Even, I mean, maybe not in the king's like presence one-on-one, although that kind of thing will happen, but just as the king comes through the gate or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I have a hard time imagining that he didn't do that for the king. I don't know, but I don't know. Yes.
All of that makes a lot of sense in ways maybe we haven't thought of it before, but if the point is that he continues to not bow down after this, given his grief about what's about to happen to the people, I have a hard time believing there's not a lot of principle tied up to why he's
yeah.
not doing this.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, I think he would have immediately backtracked off of the idea of just, you know, it's pettiness.
Yeah.
So it has to be somehow at least a combination of the two.
I'll present some more evidence for that in just a minute. I don't know what the answer is to this, but you're right. It seems to be more complicated than that.
Right.
Yeah. You'd think he'd be pragmatic enough to understand that maybe if I can go like apologize or back down now, maybe we can reverse this decree or something like that. It's that
he's
that part.
Concerned about the consequences.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 But yet not to the point of bowing down to maybe try to fix the problem. So
which sounds like a principle.
Yeah, it does. It does.
But if it,
oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And for a little bit of a compromise, you did mention the fact that as the book goes on, Esther and Mordecai seem to maybe take the role of God a little bit more seriously, see his providence.
Yep.
So that could speak to that. It could have started selfishly, it could have started more personally,
yep.
but as he sees the consequence of his action and leans more on God, then the principle behind not bowing down all of a sudden becomes a lot more important
yep.
than his personal vendetta.
Excellent point. Dave, what were you saying?
I was going to say, but if it is petty, I mean, it goes beyond just I should honor him, but I'm not going to. That type of thing. It's disobeying the king at the same time.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, it's there's more consequences than just
yeah. Although
petty,
I mean, you know, have you ever known of someone to do something extremely petty, despite the very serious consequences, just because they don't want to?
Oh, sure.
But have you ever had a kid? The answer is yes.
Yeah. But I mean, certainly have.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, there's serious consequences that go with this.
Yeah.
He's willing to risk for that pettiness in the presence of
right.
a lot of folks.
No, I agree. But I do think, to Abby's point, that Mordecai can serve us as an example of the kind of person who thinks they can take care of themselves, spiritually or otherwise, until they discover that the stone that they've been pushing up the hill is now rolling back on them, and then they call for God's help or for someone else's. However you read it, I would encourage you to at least take that application away, that all of us, as we're conducting ourselves in the world, trying to assimilate to the extent that we can for God's purposes, we need to realize the extent to which we are dependent on God's help. Recognize those moments when we are kind of out of our depth and turn to Him for that help. No, so this is not directly related to Mordecai, but Haman overreacts, which is totally typical for the way the Persians are depicted in the book of Esther. One Jew has offended his pride, therefore all Jews must die. It's typical overkill in this book. Just like, you know, one woman has disobeyed her husband, therefore we've got to make a law that says you're not allowed to do that in the whole kingdom. And it's, of course, possible. One commentator I read noted that it's possible that Haman thinks that all Jews are going to do the same thing. It's a little bit unlikely, given that there must have been other Jews in the city who were bowing down to Haman. We know there were other Jews in the city. Presumably they were bowing down. But maybe he thinks that. Maybe this is part of the irrationality of Haman, that he says, well, if this guy does it, then everybody will do it, which would be kind of in line with the way the version is depicted. Yes.
This will be really quick.
Yes, sir.
Also, on a point of assimilation, in Mordecai's decision to do this, it could also be in the thought of not that my race is going to be targeted because I'm not an other. Like, I'm part of the society. I'm just one of these people. My personal choice to do this is just another citizen. And then, again, if you see, like, a change over the Book of Esther, his identity of a Jew, it becomes much more important. And when you're applying that to us, it's we can see ourselves as part of the society. But when problems come and when our faith is attacked, then it's like, oh yeah, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not one of these people. I'm different. And this could be Mordecai's lesson in that.
We're going to see some parallels later between Esther and Moses. And it's along those lines that I think Mordecai's character arc might fit into it as well. That idea of deciding like Moses did to identify with God's people could be part of what is going on in his mind. So let's read verses 7 through 11. I'm not going to really cover in detail 12 through the end of the chapter because it's the minutia of sending out this. This decree. So, with your permission, I'm going to skip that. But if someone could read verses 7 through 11.
In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pur, that is, they cast lots before him in day after day, and they cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of every other people, and they do not keep the king's laws. So that is not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it please the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king's business, that they may put it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you."
Thanks. And go ahead and read verse 15, just for fun.
15?
Yes.
The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa the citadel. And the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion.
Okay. So Haman makes his plans for revenge. I find this fascinating. He casts lots before he takes action. It's like Haman realizes that some things are outside of human control. That there are some things that he can't plan for, and so we're going to involve a higher power in this endeavor. Now, I should apologize to Julie for making you read the Jewish calendar, but that is an important point for the story we'll come back to later, that all of the times are given on the Jewish calendar, not the Persian calendar. We'll talk about the significance of that later, but since it came up in this reading, I'll just point that out as something you can look out for. And there are websites you can go to see the Jewish calendar and how it's structured. It's a lunar calendar, so it kind of, like the Chinese calendar, the beginning of the year falls on a different day every year on the Gregorian calendar. But I just think it's interesting that Haman, at this point in the story, uniquely among all the characters, says some things are outside of my control, so I'm going to involve a higher power in my decision. It maybe doesn't mean anything, just trivia, but I think it's interesting. So he presents this case to the king to make this law, and it's like typical conspiracy theory, like there's a people and they don't obey the laws. You know what I mean? He's overselling it and giving no details. But no, let's break down his argument a little bit. He tells one thing that is true but misleading, that the Jews' laws are different from other people's. Is that true? It is. They have another set of laws that they also obey. Do you remember another place where it's kind of specifically pointed out that their laws are different and that's bad for the kingdom? No. It's in the Bible.
Oh, Daniel.
Yes.
Where he bowed and prayed to God.
Yep. That was part of their accusation to the king, is that he obeys different rules, And the implication is that they don't obey your laws. They have their own set of laws and they ignore your laws. That's not really true. Until the king made a decree against praying, and then Daniel did disobey the king's law. But in this case, it is true, but he implies some things that are not true based on that. He tells one thing that's partially true, that they don't obey the king's law. What is actually true is that one Jew disobeyed one law. But Haman casts it as all of them disobey all laws. And then he tells one thing that's just completely false, that it's not in the king's interest that they be preserved. The reason that's a total lie is what happened at the end of chapter 2. The Jews saved the king's life. So is it in the king's interest to preserve them? At least in that one case, who, by the way, is the case that this law is based on, it is very much in the king's interest to preserve these people. But again, back to our kind of character description of Ahasuerus, note that he doesn't ask any questions. He doesn't even try to find out who these people are. He just says, yeah, sure, go for it. Not a very effective ruler. Haman also offers to pay the king an improbably vast sum to get the law made. I read this and I can't find the source. I couldn't find the source preparing for class. The sum that Haman's offering is like multiple times the king's annual revenue from taxes. So it would be like someone saying today, I will pay off the national debt and give you three times that on top. Right? That's the effect of what Haman is offering. Which kind of raises the question, where does Haman get all this money from? Well, it could be that what he's really doing is just offering to pay the implementation costs of the decree. So he's not actually bribing him. He's just saying, I'll pay for this law to be implemented, even if it costs, 10,000 talents. That's a possibility. It could also be exaggerated, either Haman exaggerating or the narrator exaggerating, for dramatic effect to show how serious Haman is about this. How much is this law worth to you? It's worth 10,000 talents to get this law passed.
Some have thought that it also is an implied understanding that you will gain this from the Jews who are all dead.
So, yeah, that's
possession of what they have.
Right.
And so, one way or the other, you're going to benefit. From this event.
Right. So, there are two ways of kind of reading the plunder part into it. One is that Haman can promise this kind of on credit because he knows he'll be repaid by the plunder that he'll take. The other is that what he's saying is, if you do this, you will eventually get this. That he's promising the king this booty as a result of this law being passed. Either way you look at it, he could have in mind the spoil that they will be gathering. But I think in a Jewish context, it's intended to remind readers of laws and warnings against bribery and corruption. Whether it's a bribe or a promise on credit, he's still paying money for a law. And the Proverbs and the prophets are full of warnings and cautions against a kingdom that can be bought, where laws are made, judgments are passed down for money. And I think we're supposed to see that in play. The other thing that's funny, again, it's kind of typical Haman, is he can't even wait for the law to go into effect. At the end of chapter 5, after he's finished bragging about how great he is to his own wife, he decides, well, I'm just going to kill Mordecai before the decree even goes into effect. I'm going to kickstart him. See, he's going to kill the guy who was the reason for the decree, and then he's going to go ahead and fulfill the decree anyway. I mean, you just see his impatience and his sort of self-centeredness here, that whatever I want, I've got to have it, even if it costs me 10,000 talents. Anyway, the other thing to point out about this chapter in verse 15 about the king and Haman sitting down to drink, again, notice the connection between drinking and passing laws. But the city's in confusion because this law has been passed, that the Jews are all supposed to be killed, and the king and Haman are just having a good time in the palace, right? The king is totally clueless about what's going on in his own backyard. And we're going to see that again crop up in the story, but this is part of what we're supposed to see in this is not the way to run an empire.
In fact, when he has trouble sleeping in the next chapter,
yes,
who is this Mordecai of the Jews? Yeah. He knew he was a Jew.
That's right. Yeah, I should have pointed that out earlier. Mordecai is clearly Jewish. He doesn't hide that. It's in this chapter. It's in the record, the official record. So that means that his connection to Esther has to be kind of hidden somehow. That's a good point. I want to point out another quick set of parallels between Mordecai and Joseph. They're both raised to positions of importance. Mordecai's sitting in the gate. Joseph is in charge of Potiphar's whole house. And in that context, they are both pressured to engage in improper behavior. However you define improper as either ungodly or just unsavory. But Mordecai's pressured to bow to Haman, and Joseph, of course, is pressured to sleep with Potiphar's wife. And this, to Russ's point, this parallel might be more evidence that this is a matter of principle and not a personal grudge or something. Against that, I would say that parallels in Scripture do not have to line up perfectly. Think of the sign of Jonah that Jesus cites as a description of what would happen to him when he was buried. Jonah was not a Christ-like figure before or after the 3 days in the belly of the fish, and yet Jesus points that out as a parallel. So it doesn't have to be, but I think in the context, it might sway you that way. But there are some phrases that are identical, that he was appealed to day by day and that he would not listen. Those both show up in Genesis and in Esther. Oh, I misspelled Esther. Sorry about that. And they're both falsely accused before their masters, and they both could be killed in punishment for their actions. And yet, after all this works out, both will save God's people from destruction against great odds, and they'll be promoted to second in the kingdom. And I think we're supposed to see this parallel. But here's the thing. I put this last line up there because it's an obvious parallel between Mordecai and Joseph. But don't look at that yet, because we don't know that in the story. At this point in the story, all we know is this. And the question for us is supposed to be, is Mordecai going to be rescued from destruction? Is he going to be elevated like Joseph? Are the promises to Abraham, as evidenced in Joseph's story, still valid for Jews in the diaspora? And will God act to save Mordecai like he acted to save Joseph? We're supposed to be asking these questions as we read the text. Is this parallel going to continue, or does it just stop here and things turn out worse for Mordecai than they do for Joseph? So, I know you know how it ends, but keep these questions in mind as you read through the text to look for the way that the story is building this tension around how things will work out. All right, lesson 5 for next time, and chapters 4 and 5. Thank you.
Party that Charles has, I'll never leave.